Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 362, I have the pleasure of being joined by Drs. Zafar Rahmani, Catherine Talcott, and Akshay Thomas for a preview of the October 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician is a free publication, online and in print, that has various articles concerning the world of retinal disease and pathology. This month's issue focuses on uveitis. Specifically, we talk about uveitis clinical trials, uveitis diagnostic dilemmas. Then we transition to a discussion of an evaluation of different types of floaters and end with a discussion of macular hole surgery in the setting of concomitant cataract surgery. As always, you can find a link in the episode description to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. You can also find a list of financial disclosures for all participants. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the October 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is published in print and online. You can access it for free at retinalphysician.com. And I'm joined by three of my colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Zafar Rahmani from Chicago. Zafar, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I also have Dr. Catherine Talcott from Cleveland.
Great to be here.
And last but not least, Dr. Akshay Thomas from Nashville, not Memphis, as some are wont to believe.
Thanks for having me, Ajay.
So we're going to talk about a few articles in Retinal Physician. Just as a reminder, again, if you want to read these articles, you can go access them online. We're not going to go through every single part of them, just use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article by a friend of the podcast, Shruti Arapalli. This article is about current clinical trials in uveitis, and it goes through different medications and different trials. And I think this is interesting. You know, I think a lot of us, we talk ad nauseum about trials for AMD and DME and DR, and even occasionally the redhead stepchild that is RVO. But we don't talk much about uveitis. It's like if RVO is the redhead stepchild, uveitis is like the second cousin we see once a family reunion every 5 years. And so we've got these trials that are going on. They talk a little bit about minocycline as an anti-inflammatory, obviously it's an antibiotic, but in the tetracycline class, but as an anti-inflammatory for uveitis. Talks about intravitreal sirolimus for uveitis. And then they move into a discussion of subcutaneous therapy with interleukin 17-8 blocker. And there's a whole host of other trials that are ongoing. But I usually go to the punchline, which is what's in phase three, what's kind of on the horizon. And the big phase three trials involve drugs that we know about, adalimumab, methotrexate. There is this one trial in GI-associated uveitis, which is baricitinib, which is in phase three right now being compared against adalimumab. And then you get into, again, more sirolimus trials, uveitic glaucoma. And these trials are from everywhere across the country. And then you have your post-market trials, which again, include your fluocinolone implant, which is also known as UTIC on the market, and then adalimumab as well. Akshay, you are our resident uveitis hero for many, I'm sure. I don't really hear much about uveitis trials. I thought this was interesting for me as an update, because I just not that familiar with all these things that are going on. What are you most excited about on the horizon? And obviously we'll list disclosures and things like that, but just on the record, like, what's kind of stands out to you that you think that we should be looking at?
Yeah, so I think what I'm most excited about is having anything non-steroidal that will treat uveitic CME. So, you know, some of the things you mentioned, like intravitreal sirolimus, you know, Guangwen has done a lot of studies, you know, Sakura Save 1, Save 2, looking at sirolimus for, you know, inflammation, including like vitreous haze and stuff like that. But we still need to see how it does with uveitic CME. Not listed there, but potentially coming down the pipeline are intravitreal IL-6 inhibitors. So think of like your tocilizumab, except an intravitreal agent. So you can imagine if we had a bunch of steroid responders that have tons of CME that we can't do anything for, and you suddenly have an agent that you can inject and get rid of their CME, that'd be great. I think a lot of the stuff you mentioned, you know, the agents we already use, you know, Humira, methotrexate, there's a lot of great studies going on just comparing them head to head, right? I mean, these are things we've used for decades in cases, and we have no idea other than just our own individual experience whether one works better than the other for our patients. And there's finally, you know, studies going on right now to actually compare what's better, Humira or methotrexate, and hopefully it'll allow us to overcome some of the hurdles we face with insurers that are like, no, before you put someone on Humira, they need to try and fail methotrexate or azathioprine or CellCept and stuff like that. So those are probably some of the things I'm most excited about. One thing I'd mention, one class of medication we're seeing a lot of, not just in the uveitis space, but in a lot of rheumatologic diseases, are the JAK inhibitors, the Janus kinase inhibitors that you mentioned, like in JIA, and we have a lot of them coming out for adult uveitis. Those are interesting. I think there's a little bit of concern with them for some of us. You know, there was a big phase 3 trial that was nearly at completion recently for uveitis, looking at filgotinib, which was from Gilead, and they stopped the study because they didn't get their RA label because of potential testicular toxicity and thromboembolic events. So, I mean, these are all very, very scary medications, you know, in case, even if they control inflammation very well, the side effect profile is certainly something we're always paying close attention to.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. You brought up costs and insurance, and this is the sort of thing that comes up, right? Because these drugs are not created equally in terms of the cost to society in the system, but there's all sorts of other costs associated with, you know, patients needing to come in the office, for example, for local therapy when they can go get their therapy outside. And there's a big difference with something like that can be given administered at home, like adalimumab, versus something that's an infusion, like when people used to more commonly receive infliximab, for example. You know, Kat and Safa, you guys don't do uveitis. You're like me. You're just in awe of Akshay here talking about uveitis. You know, I would transition and maybe ask your opinion as we talk about uveitis more in general. There's this other article by Dennis Wang about uveitis and autoimmune disease. And this is all about workup, essentially, right? So how do you sort of separate out? This is, I think, both the exciting and exhilarating part of uveitis, which is the discovery and trying to figure out what's happening, and also the frustrating part about uveitis, which is a lot of times you don't get an answer. And I was just having a conversation with a friend recently about this very frustration that can come up, is how do you sort of counsel these patients? I know both of your institutions where you have access to uveitis specialists, but oftentimes you are the first one to, say, see the patient if they show up as a new patient. You know, Safa, what does that discussion sound like? So I know part of the end of the discussion is go see my resident Akshay Thomas, and he'll take great care of you, but they're going to have some questions and they're going to have some things they want to know about. So what do you sort of tell people? Because I think the term uveitis, the conversation we were having the other day was, it's much easier in some ways in terms of counseling to talk to patients about ocular oncology than uveitis, because cancer is sort of a buzzword for the layperson. They hear cancer and people are dialed in, they understand what that is. They may not understand all the nuances of what you're talking about, but all of a sudden they're like, this is important, this is critical. Uveitis is a term that most of us don't hear unless we go into ophthalmology or we're a rheumatologist. So I guess the question for you is, how do you sort of convey importance? How do you answer questions when they have questions about, well, why exactly did this happen to me?
Yes, I think those are great points. And there are a couple of things that I want to sort of mention. First is uveitis is a time where in our busy clinics is when you really have to stop and get the history. You know, we're so used to kind of going through the diabetics and the AMDs and the RVOs and the sort of bread and butter retina. And when something doesn't, you know, fit, you really need to take the time in a busy clinic to stop and ask the questions. You know, and I'm a pediatric retina trained, so I don't claim to know any uveitis, but it's similar in terms of slowing down and trying to get exactly what's going on, what's the story. I almost never, the first few times that I see these patients, use the term uveitis. I always just say inflammation. You know, your body's attacking something, or something's attacking your cells in your eyes. So inflammation, you know, especially with the buzzwords of, you know, in the social media culture, people understand inflammation. You know, people talk about all these oils for anti-inflammatory, you know, so I almost never use uveitis. And that, I think, kind of conveys the importance of why we need to do workups and kind of figure out what's going on, because I always kind of try to break it down like, oh, it could be an infection, or it could be something that your cells are doing to your body. And that conveys the importance and kind of sets the tone for trying to figure out what's going on. And I always say something is going on to allow the time that it really is needed to work up these patients and come up, you know, figure out what's going on, whether it's X, Y, and Z. So.
Yeah, and actually, we're going to bring you back in a second. Kat, I want to get your thoughts. I feel there are certain things, and they go into sarcoidosis and BKH, but Safa brought up a great point about the tunnel vision we get in our clinics, where we're moving fast, we're seeing common things. Common things are common, right? Most patients with subretinal fluid don't have BKH. They'll have AMD, they'll have a CNVM, they'll have CSR in a standard retina clinic. But there are certain things that you just can't miss, and you can easily miss if you're going fast. And I think that, for example, I think a common one is flashes of light, floaters. Most of those patients are in the PVD spectrum somewhere, PVD, tear detachment, at least in a retina clinic. But some of those patients have real pathology. And I've had patients in my clinic, for example, with birdshot, who have seen multiple providers and diagnosed with PVD and floaters, and they actually have birdshot. And there's very subtle sort of signs of that. If you look at for phlebitis and on-phos-OT, or if you get an FA, then it's very obvious. And then you do an ICG and it's even more obvious because you see the hypotonicinus in spots. But I guess one point is a lot of uveitis is actually misdiagnosed. It's very rare that uveitis, it's not rare, I would say, but it's not uncommon for a uveitis patient to not be diagnosed by the first eye provider they see.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's sort of encapsulated my sort of approach to sort of what uveitis looks like in my practice and what I'm paying attention to. I'm so fortunate to be in an institution where we now have five uveitis specialists. So I think when I was a fellow and when I first started, I wanted to make sure I still understood like what all the different types of conditions are, how to tease them apart. And now my perspective has really changed, where I'm more focused on just not missing bad things in my clinic. And I think you brought up the best example, the one that I keep in mind of a lot of is floaters. Because I think floaters for most of us are sort of PVD, but you don't want to miss the lymphoma. You don't want to miss the birdshot patient. So like I try and pay attention to if someone's been sent to me for floaters and they've seen multiple people before, I try and just slow down and make sure I'm not missing anything. Is there, you know, shadowing on the OCT? Does this person's age sort of make sense? Am I seeing anything else in the periphery? And if I'm getting sort of any sense that things are a little different, even if I'm not seeing something clear, I'll just have a lower threshold for seeing those people back. And then the other sort of point that I try and keep in mind is, you know, I think I've become a lot more comfortable with, you know, I'm not a uveitis provider. I'm so happy to have lots of people around me. But when I'm sending those patients to a uveitis person, I just try and make sure that the workup that I'm getting is helpful and not hurtful for them. So if I'm going to order labs and make someone get labs or imaging, I just want to make sure I'm getting the right stuff that they would want. And, you know, I sometimes will start, you know, getting an FA on patients, but if I know they're going to get one in a week or so, you know, and they need an ICG and I can't get them an ICG, I just try and like really coordinate with my sort of uveitis colleagues instead of sort of doing things sort of twice, rather doing it like right the first time.
Akshay, we've all been waiting with bated breath because we are all the gatekeepers, but you are the man behind the fortress. So your thoughts, again, you're the one who sees patients. You're the one who can look at the record, see how many providers they've seen, what's been done, how they sort of arrive to you. Would you agree that a lot of these patients take a circuitous route to finally getting diagnosed?
Yeah, sometimes I do think it's getting better. And I think it's probably getting better in part because a lot more people are just using wide field imaging. You know, optometrists, comprehensive ophthalmologists have access to an Optos or a Clarus, and they're maybe seeing some vascular sheathing or snowballs or stuff that many of us might have missed on an otherwise asymptomatic patient. The one point I'd make is that oftentimes you're not going to have access to a uveitis provider. And so retina doctors do their best to co-manage these patients with their rheumatologist. The most important thing I can tell you is that you as the ophthalmologist retina provider are responsible for getting the correct lab workup. Almost every patient I've seen that's gone to a rheumatologist end up with the same set of labs that rheumatologists are used to getting. You know, ANAs, ANCAs, rheumatoid factors, B27, they're just not the most common causes of eye inflammation, especially not panuveitis. So knowing that differential and knowing what you're looking for should kind of guide the ophthalmologist to initiate the correct laboratory workup. And the point is not just having the eye inflammation under control, which was the point of the article, but it's not missing sarcoid and someone having, you know, cardiac sarcoid, which can cause an arrhythmia and they could die from, right? Or I just had a patient with AMPI that got a cerebral vasculitis. So I think it's about remembering those associations, doing the workup to the best of your ability, and understand your limitations. I mean, there are patients that go to uveitis providers out of state because they feel, you know, the provider that's taking care of them just doesn't feel adequately equipped to handle it, and that's the right move. You know, you shouldn't do things outside your comfort zone. Just like I wouldn't do tumors or peds, you know, I wouldn't expect someone else to try to immunosuppress a patient they're not comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and this sort of ties in a little bit. They didn't talk about uveitis in this next article, but the next article is about diagnosis of floaters, kind of going back to what I was just talking about with birdshot and other things that can give you floaters, ends of the feet. And this is by Thomas Mendel, and he talks about different reasons. He goes through three kind of main reasons for floaters: PVD, vitreous hemorrhage without tear, sort of differential for that, which includes obviously peripheral diabetic retinopathy or hemorrhagic PVD, and then lymphoma and lymphocytes and inflammation and neoplastic causes of that. And, you know, I think vitritis has to always be there. And I think that one of the easiest ways to sort, or I guess simplest ways to distinguish that we often lose sight of in our busy clinics is you can't distinguish the cause of haze very easily with an indirect exam. But I think the slit lamp exam and looking behind the lens is actually very, very helpful because it does take some time to learn. I think as people listening or retina specialists know this from residency, there is sort of a nuance for post-SAPA to distinguishing red blood cells, RPE cells, and white cells. They're all very different, but all can give you haze. And I think they're very commonly mistaken for one another. You know, I feel often we'll get patients who have been told they have, you know, potential endophthalmitis uveitis, and they actually just have chronic hemorrhage that's broken through and looks yellow, and they have ghost cell essentially without the glaucoma. I have patients who have told they have a PVD, the positive Schaefer sign, and they have, like I said, they have vitritis and they have something else going. They may have pars planitis, they may have something else. So I think that's kind of an exam skill that's been lost. And actually, we can maybe talk about this after we talk about this. Probably better imaging in the future will capture those differences between them. It won't just be us looking at them, we'll be able to distinguish the size of those and be able to tell which of those it is. But I think that's a very, very helpful way when you have floaters. Now, any other tips for kind of evaluating patients with floaters? What's your approach when someone comes in?
Yeah, so one of my mentors a while ago said, we're also vitreous doctors. Don't forget that you're a vitreous doctor as well. You know, we are vitreoretinal surgeons. So I think your point of really using the slit lamp to hone those skills is critical as a fellow and resident. You know, as a pediatric person, I look at vitreous all the time because I, you know, my bread and butter is Stickler's and Marfan and all sorts of, you know, connective tissue disease. So I really try to, you know, kind of let the fellows and residents know, do not forget about the vitreous and actually looking at the vitreous. And there's, you know, many times where there's no way I would have been able to diagnose what's going on if I had not looked at the vitreous, but with the slit lamp specifically. That's how I use for diagnosis. So I think, you know, we are vitreous doctors in addition to retina doctors. So I think it's a critical skill to develop and not lose. When we get into busy practice, you know, the looking at the vitreous briefly and slit lamp should really be for every new patient and probably every patient afterwards.
Okay, your thoughts, any stories or anecdotes on kind of patients with floaters who end up not having what it seemed at first?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I really like the point that you sort of made that, you know, I think exam skills are important. We would also probably benefit though from other imaging modalities to be able to sort of better tell these things apart. I feel like one of the things that I've relied upon when I'm thinking back to patients who were sent to me with floaters who ended up having like birdshot or like lymphoma is sometimes there'll be so much that you actually get shadowing on the OCT. That's been something that's been like a good sign to sort of make me sort of think twice. Or, you know, if I compare, because I usually get OCTs in all my patients to something before, if there's been a change. And then I know some groups, this is not really for like vitritis so much, but I know that there's some work being done to look at like anterior segment OCTs about like quantifying cell in that way. So, I mean, I think exam skills are incredibly important here, but I think that for these patients where, you know, something just seems a little atypical from the amount that they're complaining about, their floaters, or they look a little different, if we had some better imaging way to sort of be able to sort of rule out badness, I think that in some ways would be helpful.
Akshay, I'm sure you're the king of stories of what's going on. I mean, you heard us talk a little bit about lost exam skills, I guess, from an imaging perspective. I mean, I feel like it's theoretically possible that you could design something that can distinguish a white cell, a red cell, an RPE cell, like a shape positive, shape or sign, pretty easily and reliably. I just think probably the reason we don't have that is it's just not a market yet. It's motivating it to be done. Any thoughts on sort of imaging? I know people have talked about cell meters and flare meters and things like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys both mentioned, I know both Cleveland Clinic and OHSU are both looking at OCT-based studies to kind of differentiate and separate and grade anterior chamber and vitreous cells. The one comment I was going to add in addition to, you know, yes, maintain our examination skills is, you know, the type of equipment you have, your slit lamp, it's very easy to think that you're seeing everything, but you're not. You know, I still remember in residency where, you know, I would use one slit lamp, which was slightly, didn't have as strong of a light. And then my mentor would say, take this patient to the next room with what I consider a real slit lamp. And you see all these cells that you didn't see before. And I think for all of us, not just for the patient coming with floaters, all of us are involved in clinical trials. And we know that there are patients getting inflammation in trials and we're the ones examining them and assessing for rates of inflammation. If you're looking with a very dim light at that anterior vitreous, you can very, very easily miss all sorts of vitreous cells, even if they don't have any haze or discernible floaters. So you really have to make sure you have an adequate light source for assessing the vitreous, just like you would for anterior chamber cells.
Let's talk about this last write-up, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but this is often true with retinal physician. There's like three articles that go together, and then we have a fourth one that's kind of unrelated, but kind of interesting. So Avni Finn making a cameo appearance. We had to fit Avni somewhere. She was a senior author on this article, which is about cataract surgery considerations around macular hole surgery. And I think this is interesting because we talk about cataract surgery in the context of DME and even ERMs. I feel like this comes up less frequently, but is still relevant. And so they talk about, what do you think about in terms of the cataract surgery? Which one do you do first? What's the timing? When would you consider doing the cataract surgery first? When would you consider doing them at the same time? When would you do the cataract surgery after the vitrectomy? And then different sort of lenses and the pros and cons. Talk about silicone lenses and multifocal lenses and hydrophobic lenses. And again, I'll just say, I think most of us in the retina community understand that multifocal lenses in patients with already reduced contrast sensitivity is not necessarily a good idea. And unfortunately, we see patients a lot of the time with macular pathology with multifocal lenses. Probably a lot of it is just not due to imaging the macula before putting the lens in. And then once it's in, it's not difficult to take out, but it's less than optimal to remove a lens because the patient can't exactly return it to the store and get their check back for the money they spent. So Safa, what do you think? I mean, they went through some reasons compelling both ways. What's your usual approach? Patient comes in with the mac hole, they're 60, let's say, they're phakic. Do you worry about the cataract? Do you just say, I'll take care of it later? How do you sort of decide? And what does them being phakic or pseudophakic change anything for you in terms of what you do in surgery, your gas tamponade positioning, things like that?
I think a lot of it has to do with the timing of when the macular hole and when I'm seeing them. You know, I'm going to assume this is a relatively, you know, recent macular hole that's come in. With those cases, I really try to take them in more, you know, more in a timely fashion than not. And depending on how bad the cataract is, I pretty much always just tell them, you're going to need cataract surgery afterwards, but this is a more important surgery. This is more difficult surgery, and it will affect your vision much more. So we will take care of the macular hole surgery first, and then you will get cataract surgery after because your cataract will get worse. In the off chance that, you know, the cataract's bad enough where I don't think I can do my surgery safely, which has happened. It's not that common, but it has happened. I try to coordinate a phacoid with one of our cataract surgeons. And I usually, based on my OR day, I try to see who's in the, you know, in the OR vicinities on the same day and sort of tap that cataract surgeon for a combined procedure. But I feel like a lot of the macular holes that at least that I have in my population are sort of under 65 or so. And cataracts are usually not the driving factor of my limited, you know, in terms of visibility. It's mostly timing and getting the patient in. And I just tell all of them, you're going to need cataract surgery afterwards and sort of make that very clear that this is a side effect of my surgery. And sort of for that, there's no surprises. So.
Kat, you know, we both traded with Carl Wagillo, and he used to do this graph with his hands that I can't communicate to our audio only audience, but he used to tell patients and tell us, he's like, look, the problem sometimes has, and they just need to understand it, is they're going to have macular sole surgery and the retina is going to take time to recover. And so their vision is getting better because the retina going up. But as that's happening, the cataract is going down. So there's this inflection point. So most patients feel like it improves for the first few months and then it gets worse. And a lot of them are worried the hole's coming back, something bad's happening, even if you've talked to them about the cataract. Are there scenarios, Kat, where you just combo them? What would incline you to do combo surgery for a macular hole?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We actually talk a lot about it at our institution because my colleague Peter Kaiser published a paper showing that a small but not 0% of patients who have had macular hole surgery, the hole have closed, and then they have cataract surgery, that they have an increased risk of the hole opening up again. So we actually talk about this all the time. And I'm like the outlier at my institution where I don't like to combo cases. It's just, it's hard to coordinate. It takes away from my block time. It's another thing to think about. I feel like those patients always have like more post-op inflammation than they would normally. They always have Sinikea afterwards. So I try and avoid it. The only instance in which I sort of do it is if I feel like it's dense enough that for some reason I'm not going to be able to peel. But that's only really with like a pretty dense like PSE. I actually think the view is like much more predictable often on phakic patients than it is on pseudophakic patients, especially if they have some sort of multifocal. So I remember my co-fellow at Wills actually, Farina Ali, talking about how she loves feeling peeling on phakic patients. And so that's actually stuck with me. Like I don't think it really sort of impairs anything. And I just tell patients like your vision's going to get worse afterwards. And then I get them plugged in sooner. I think the other thing that I think this article addresses lots of things, but one of the things that it sort of doesn't mention is that it takes forever to get patients in to see cataract surgeons and then get cataract surgery these days. Like we're at like a 3-month delay between when they get signed up and when the surgery happens. It'd be really hard to have a patient get cataract surgery first, unless you're asking like a favor from the cataract surgeon. So
we don't think macular hole surgery is an emergency generally, but it should optimally be done. I think most of us agree within a month if it's a new hole, that's what we want for our eyes. It's kind of hard to coordinate the surgery, the recovery, everything like that. I am mostly on this camp, unless the cataract is so visually significant you can't do it, or it's just very expensive, or they're not able to come twice to just do the mac hole. I guess go back to my question, Astapa. Do you change anything if a patient's phakic versus pseudophakic when they come for macular hole surgery? Does that change your tamponade, your positioning, the amount of ILM you feel, or do you do everything exactly the same?
No, I think I do everything exactly the same. I try to shave pretty well. And obviously the shave with a pseudophakic is much easier. I'm a conservative C3 F8 camp, so it doesn't change my management.
Asha, how about you?
I'm gonna find a way to tie this into the other three articles. The one situation which I'll consider cataract surgery outside of this standard is if and so a lot of our uveitic patients, they get vitreous contraction, they get macular holes. And so if that patient, just like Kat said, if they have cataract surgery and they get a bunch of CME, there's a risk of hole reopening. So in those patients, sometimes I try to have their cataract removed first, let them heal, and then do their macular hole. The other group I'd say is anyone that I'm planning anything remotely fancy. So if we have like a myopic macular hole, or there's second surgery or something, I'm trying fancy and I'm like, I'm not quite sure if I have an adequate view, I'll usually just let them have their cataract surgery first. But for a typical run of the mill macular hole, I'm usually just doing it, whether they're fake or pseudophakic, pretty much the same thing. And I typically use SF6.
You know, the reason I ask that, and again, it probably matters very little clinically, I do think that you're more likely to get a slight underfill cat in a phakic patient than a pseudophakic patient. And so I may be a little more, in the end, I think probably do the same thing anyway, but it just makes, I'm more likely to use expansile gas and or suture if it's a phakic patient, especially if I know the patient can't position as well. That's why I brought up the question. I'm curious, anything you change for your patients?
I do everything exactly the same. I mean, now as I operate tomorrow, I'm going to be thinking if I should be doing things differently for my field patients, but I do everything exactly the same.
One thing I have seen like in some patients, and again, we don't do a ton of combo cases, but you know, sometimes if a patient has a phaco and then any type of retina surgery with gas tamponade, I've seen occasionally they have a generous anterior rexus, you know, having that optic kind of prolapse and get in front of the iris. So that's one of the other reasons I'm always a little bit concerned about, you know, like a combo surgery. I'm like, oh gosh, when I depress, am I going to burp their corneal wound? Am I going to have to like, is their AC going to flatten? Is their lens going to like, you know, like prolapse anteriorly? So those are other reasons why I just prefer to have them separated in some way, shape or form if possible.
I totally agree. I just feel like I end up sort of having to watch more things if we're doing combos, you know, you have to sort of make sure the AC doesn't deepen. There's so much more equipment needed in the room. Otherwise, often it's stressful for everyone. It's just,
if you're going to do a combo, you got to be very careful about the size of your Rexus. If you're going to use a one piece lens, because I think that as staff fellows, I think a lot of them are very excited to make big Rexus because it's easy to get things out, pieces out of the bag. You just stop and chop. And I'm always like, no, small is fine. Just make it small. I don't want to worry about the eye. Well, I said the only two things that I need from you, I was like, I don't even need you to preserve the posterior capsule if you can't do that. I need the cornea to be relatively clear at the end, right? So phaco deeper, don't phaco right by the endothelium, and don't overhydrate your wounds at the end right before you're like, okay, let's do it. But also keep the Rexus reasonably sized, because that will get you into trouble if you need gas in the back for any reason. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining. We're recording this before Academy. Looking forward to seeing you. All three of you guys, I think, are going. Well, Safa's staying put, but the rest of us are going to her. But looking forward to it. We'll have some stories and some knowledge we'll acquire. We'll learn more about uveitis clinical trials, I'm sure, at the Academy meeting. I'm sure all of the podium talks will be about uveitis clinical trials. Uveitis should have its own sub day. Does it have its own sub day?
It does.
It does, but it's a one day, just on Saturday.
Yes.
Okay. So actually, how do you decide between retina and uveitis on Saturday? That's a tough one.
Oh gosh, no. I think like retina, I just do ASRS, and then Academy, I kind of do everything else.
Okay.
So I'll just do uveitis mostly at Academy.
We see which team you're on, actually. We get it. Right. All right, guys. Have a great night. See you soon.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for having us.
Many thanks to Drs. Romani, Talcott, and Thomas for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember you can find this episode and all of our other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You'll find all 362 episodes, including this one, sorted by category, easily searchable and archived. On the website, you can subscribe to get email updates on the most recent episodes. In addition, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and also in your favorite podcast app on your Apple or Android device. You can give us feedback at any time by clicking on the contact us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Jennifer Ford and the team at Penn Division for providing the articles in advance for this episode. Thanks to our whole team. That includes Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Mike Minacasa, Angela Ching, all of whom are critical to what we do here at the podcast. Thank you, listeners, for listening in, for what you do on a daily basis, for taking care of patients every day, and for the articles you publish and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.